Good. Okay. Yes, the Iraq war continues, right?
Every day off.
Hmm?
Every day off.
Hmm. You miss it?
Kind of.
You do, huh?
I do.
What do you miss, Neil?
The weather. I don't like when it's cold.
You miss the weather in Iraq.
No, we had a lot of good friends there. We had a lot of cool people. I miss them. They all died since I left.
Really?
Iraqis. Yeah.
They all died since you left?
Because they were all contractors. So our job was to go around the city of Fallujah and, like, you know, rebuild schools and hospitals and stuff like that. And so since we were working with them, as soon as we left, they didn't have protection, I guess, anymore. So they got, like, kidnapped.
You should really talk to us about this. Would you be interested in doing that? No.
Is that relevant to Fanon or Gramsci? I don't know how I could tie that in.
Don't worry about that.
You'll find a way.
So would you be interested in talking to a group of us about what it was like and what it is?
If anybody has, like, legitimate questions of, like, how it actually was there, I'm not going to get into, like, a political...
No.
Yeah, people are curious, huh?
Yeah. I don't feel that was somehow voyeurism on our part, but, you know...
I'm down to inform.
Yeah?
If any people have an idea that everybody goes there and just, like, kills everyone they see, but it's not the case at all.
Okay.
I think it'll be helpful.
Yes. Well, are you going to be with us next semester?
Yeah, I'm on.
You're here
to take 101B.
Very good. We may... Which New York Times?
Never mind.
Abby, I couldn't figure it out from the email she sent out.
I won't spoil it. Nothing.
You won't spoil it.
Pretend you didn't hear anything.
Why?
Because you either, like, get it or you don't.
When I
went to the link.
Yeah, and there was nothing. It was just the front page there.
Did you read it?
The whole front page? No, I didn't.
It's like
I should. But it was the front page, right?
Yes.
Okay. I looked at some of the headlines. They didn't seem. I didn't look very carefully then, right? Okay. Very good. There was something going on there. I obviously missed it, yeah? No, I better go back.
Just go look at that damn link and read the article. You tried clicking on the articles?
No.
Oh, well, they go to, like, the bigger...
No, but it was just like a front page of the New York Times. Uh-huh. Okay. Very good. Yeah, it just shows how I look at my emails. All right. So... Okay, we're a minute late. Shh. Okay. So, this is the last lecture on Gramsci. Though Gramsci, like everybody else, will be living with you the rest of your lives. But formally, I will end the discussion of Gramsci on Thursday. And then next Tuesday, we'll have a film on Fanon. And then you will have Thanksgiving when you'll educate your kin in the virtues of Lenin. And then you will come back and report the following Tuesday. And we will discuss Fanon Tuesday, Thursday, and the following Tuesday. And then we're at the end of the semester. I will give you 3 review sessions that you can voluntarily go to. But you have to ask questions, otherwise you'll get no response from me. And I'll try and give you the final examination on next Tuesday, so you can take it home with you. But why don't you say it all together? My pleasure. Okay. Right. Any questions? Now, next time, we're going to discuss... this is really going through Gramsci quite quickly, but I think you will get the basic ideas. Next time, we're going to discuss hegemony. That's really what we're going to discuss. But the particular questions are going to be around class formation, ideology, and intellectuals. And those pages 180 to 181, which are my, I think are the most important pages in Gramsci's prison notebooks, where he talks about, he says so much there, as you know, he says so much in every sentence. But anyway, there he talks about the three stages of class formation. When you read that, you should think about the three stages of class formation in the Communist Manifesto. And then we'll talk about intellectuals. Gramsci is the first Marxist to take seriously the concept of intellectual. Who are intellectuals? And he makes a distinction between organic and traditional intellectuals. And we will see how Gramsci's ideas are carried forward to the what was then called the Third World, the Global South, to Africa by Frantz Fanon. Though he didn't know he was doing that. But we will. Okay. Any questions? Okay. All right. Tricky stuff. Summary, Tuesday. The early Gramsci. 1917, writes Revolution Against Capital. This is the Gramsci who is idealistic and optimistic. Optimistic that human beings galvanized by ideas can actually shape the direction of history. He argues in that piece that there's a distinction to be made between normal times and exceptional times, or crisis times. In normal times, indeed, Marxist theory about the laws of development of capitalism and the gradual evolution of class struggle, they pertain in normal times. What Marx says, or what Engels says in Social Utopian Scientific, at least until the end, basically the idea that there are laws to the development of capitalism, that is indeed part of the characteristic of normal times. But there are also crisis times, when in fact the world is turned, in a sense, upside down, when there is great indeterminacy and uncertainty about what will happen next. When the possibilities of an alternative future suddenly, in a sense, open up. And Russia in 1917 went through such crisis period, and it was because of such a crisis period that the Bolsheviks were able to take power and to imagine taking, introducing their vision of socialism. However, they did it under the most difficult circumstances, and Gramsci says that it was impossible, really, for them to really introduce socialism, though what they tried to do was better than what would have happened if capitalism had been allowed to continue to develop. But what Gramsci gets from the Russian Revolution is the inspiration to the possibility of human beings collectively transforming the world around them. For him, then, in 1917, for Gramsci in 1917, Marxism is not so much science that explains the world, as Engels had used Marxism in Social Utopian Scientific, but for Gramsci, Marxism becomes what we might call ideology, a system of ideas that grips people and mobilizes and motivates them, galvanizes, atomizes individuals into this volcanic lava that will transform the world around. So for him, Marxism is a powerful ideology, set of ideas that galvanize people. Yeah. You might say, and this is the way that Gramsci uses ideology, a set of ideas that grips people's imagination. One might say, perhaps, that President-elect Obama generated some sort of ideology, set of ideas that gripped certain sections of the population and, you know, in a sense, mobilized, organized, galvanized the Obama campaign. So, yeah, this is not totally unfamiliar sort of idea. But anyway, that's the early Gramsci, the optimistic Gramsci. Then Gramsci in prison, the later Gramsci. The pessimistic Gramsci. Well, anybody in prison is probably likely to be quite pessimistic. Though many revolutionaries, of course, have been forged in prison. You know of any revolutionaries that were created in prison? Nelson Mandela. Yes, I think it's an interesting question here whether he was a revolution before, but he certainly he persisted, and certainly he was his revolutionary vision certainly was not lost. You might say it was consolidated in prison. Yes, anybody near a home? Aha! We're going to send you to prison, Conrad, so that you will develop a... You all go to prison! How about that? Malcolm X. Yes, Neil. That's the right person I was thinking. Malcolm X. I mean, his autobiography, Malcolm X, is a vivid description of how he became transformed in prison. Prisons are very often places where all sorts of re-understandings of the world develop in close collaboration, prisoners with other prisoners. Yes, yeah. Anyway, Gramsci actually moved in the opposite direction in prison. From a revolutionary, he came to reflect actually upon the failed revolution in the West, why the factory occupations in Turin had not succeeded in taking Italy towards a socialist future. In fact, in the end, took Italy towards a fascist future. So why the revolution failed in the West is really the problem that besets and preoccupies him in the prison notebooks. And there he invokes all sorts of new ideas that is for Marxism. He sort of develops the idea of the state, he develops the idea, something quite new, of civil society, the set of associations and organizations between the economy and the state. He examines the notions of ideology and the importance of ideology. Remember we talked about that very famous passage from the German ideology, perhaps famous only after Gramsci, namely the ruling ideas of the ideas of the ruling class. And of course he also developed ideas about the political party, what he called, does anybody know what he called the political party? What, how he refers to the political party in the prison notebooks? Anybody pick that up? Chelsea? The modern prince. Do you have any idea why he uses the word modern prince? It's in reference to Machiavelli's book The Prince. What is Machiavelli's book, The Prince? It's a... You're doing very well.
I haven't read it since high school.
Since high school? You read it in high school? Very sophisticated. Well, high school. Where did you go to high school, Chelsea? This is interesting.
Which, I mean, that's my way of saying I didn't really read it, but you read it in high school.
You read it in high school. Anybody else read it in high school? Machiavelli's The Prince. Now, who was saying that education in California is going down the drain? Really? What did you read? Does anybody remember what was in it? Anything in it? Anything?
Isn't it like a...
Anything?
Story about a...
A story?
How a prince should conduct himself with his people.
A story of how a prince should conduct himself with his subjects. Simeon?
I kind of read it as a manual of...
The ruling class. Well, it's actually the prince. Hold on. I mean, these were sort of princely kingdoms in Italy. Yes, Juliana.
Gramsci.
Say it big.
Gramsci is his discussion of like how to maintain consent. The balance between forcing consent and how you want to.
You're fabulous. You deserve a holiday, but you're not going to get one yet. Very good. I'm most impressed that you've met. Anybody else want to say? I saw some other hands about the modern prince. Machiavelli's prince. Anybody want to add anything? No, well, that's pretty good what we got. A manual. I like this idea of the manual. A manual for how the prince should govern his subjects, right? And yes, and very much important, very central to the idea is the idea of organizing the consent of the subjects, not through despotic rule, but through organizing consent. Very much the idea in Gramsci of hegemony, but Gramsci talks about it in connection not with the prince, but the modern prince refers to the political party which will organize consent amongst whom? With the masses, well, subordinate classes, first and foremost the working class, yes. Very good. So he's going to introduce a concept of the party very much influenced by the ideas of Machiavelli, but I might also say Lenin. Yes, very good, very good, very good. And he's also going to bring in ideas about economic concessions and how they coordinate the interests between the dominant and subordinate classes. Very good. So these are the sorts of ideas that he develops in prison. They were perhaps there slightly in his writings, you know, around 1925-26, but essentially this was a really innovative body of Marxist theory that we shall be discussing. All right, so the next point of the last point I want to make about the summary from last time is this: we talked about the state, remember. The state, according to Lenin, depends upon the irreconcilability of classes. There are classes that are in a relationship of irreconcilable antagonism. And instead of talking about an irreconcilable antagonism, at least under advanced capitalism, what we called organized capitalism, Gramsci is suggesting there is a class compromise in which the dominant class sacrifices, makes material concessions, but concessions that do not touch the essential. That is, do not affect the actual appropriation of profit. Yep. So then he also Lenin talks about the state as an organ of class repression. And Gramsci is going to suggest that that may have been the character of the Tsarist state, but it's not the character of all states. Indeed, all states do have a kernel of repression of force, but they also have apparatuses of consent. States are also in the business of organizing consent from their subjects, as well as repressing their subjects. And in fact, this is one notion of hegemony, the rule is a combination of force and consent, with force applied only with the consent of the subjects. So there's force, is the application of force is usually more or less hidden and subject to rules that the dominant class is forced to follow. And therefore, the application of force is the object of consent. And the third point about Lenin said that the state was armed bodies of armed men with prisons. Again, the emphasis is on repression, and Gramsci is going to say, no, we must look at an expanded notion of the state that includes educational apparatuses, includes legal apparatuses, welfare apparatuses, but not only an expanded notion of the state, but also what? Also the idea, so central to Gramsci and the most innovative, namely the idea of civil society. That there exists, in a sense, between the economy and the state, a set of institutions that absorb conflict and organize consent. Institutions such as schools, churches, parties, trade unions, that elicit the participation and thus the consent of people to the existing capitalist order. That is my summary. Any questions? Very good. All right, let us move on to civil society. We've talked about state and now civil society. As I said, these are the associations, a very simple idea, the associations between state and economy. Things that we take for granted, whether they be schools, voluntary organizations, neighborhood associations, trade unions, political parties, they, Gramsci says, they are the vehicle through which the ruling class under advanced capitalism is able to organize consent. So, remember this picture. What's this, Jason?
The base.
Did we have it last time? We already had it last time. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, it doesn't matter. This is part of the summary then. Base, economic base. This is the mode of production. This is the economic structure. This is the relations of production plus the what? Forces of production. Up here is the state, you might say, the superstructures. State. And what we learnt out here was what? Consciousness, particularly of the working class. And what Marx was arguing is that participation in the economy led to the development of a working class consciousness that became ever more radical through struggle. But there was also contained by ideas coming down from the states, from the superstructures, from the legal, philosophical, and ideological orders that actually may undermine that revolutionary consciousness. And what does Gramsci do? He says, look, civil society is in here. And it's connected to the state. By how many threads? How do you guess? And that also has an influence on consciousness. This is Gramsci. 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 Say it for me, Juliana. Gramsci. Gramsci. Antonio Gramsci. Very good, very good. Well, we got to sort of pay our respects to Gramsci. Right. Well, what Antonio Gramsci says is that this civil society develops in a particular period of history. He doesn't actually, fascinating enough, tell us why it appears in this moment in history, but it does appear in the West, what he calls the West, advanced capitalist countries, European countries, perhaps the United States, though that's always a special case for him. In European countries, this civil society develops. Well, it develops at the end of the 19th century. He says an interesting passage on 179. Get your readers out. 179. Are your readers as bad as mine? Mine's already falling apart. I've only used it 2 days. Yeah? I will go and complain to Muji. Okay. These readers are not holding up. We need extra tough readers for this class. 179. Okay. Where's Sienna? She's never here anymore. She's abandoned us. Our reader has abandoned us. Terrible. Aracelia! Can you read for us? Page 179, but I want your voice to reach me. 179, where it's underlined, it's all done for you. I'm listening.
In fact, it was only in 1870 to 71.
Only in 1870 to 71.
With the attempt of the Commune.
The attempt of the Paris Commune, this was sort of like organizing socialism in one city, in Paris.
That all the germs of 1789 were finally historically exhausted.
All the germs of 1789 were finally exhausted. Well, those are the feudal germs. The feudal past was finally dissipated.
It was then that the new bourgeois class...
The new bourgeois class, the ascendant bourgeois class after 1789.
Struggling for power, defeated not only the representatives of the old society, unwilling to admit that it had been... definitively superseded.
That's right. The old society, the feudal society, definitively superseded.
But also the still newer groups who maintained that the new structure created by the 17th...
So the still newer groups that had what, sorry?
Created by the 1789 revolution. Was itself already outdated. By this victory, the bourgeoisie demonstrated its vitality vis-a-vis both the old and the very new.
So who are the very new? What is the vitality of the bourgeoisie vis-a-vis the very new? The very new. The very new. The vitality vis-a-vis the old, that's the feudal order. But who are the, what is the assertion of the bourgeoisie against whom? Who are the very new? I'm mumbling down there, Kristen.
I said that the working class represented the newer groups, but I didn't know if that was necessarily the very new.
Yes, no, that's the very new. Well, you're right. You're absolutely right. You're more correct than Gramsci. Does he say the very new? Yes, well, I mean, why does he say in 1871 the very new? Because I think the working class was then really only sort of showing its muscle and its power in the 1871 commune. It was really becoming a sort of real force in 1871. In that sense, the very new. Yes, there were workers before, but they were not mobilized as a class. So yes, what Gramsci is saying is 1871, and, you know, it's a symbolic moment, you might see, the defeat of the Paris Commune. Basically, what Gramsci is saying is that 1771 marked the final defeat of feudalism, but also a defeat of the working class, who seemed to think that they were already the ascendant class. But 1871 showed, in fact, that the bourgeoisie would be able to exercise its domination over the subordinate class for a long time to come. You see, 1871 represented that initial thrust of the working class to try and organize society itself. It was repressed by the bourgeoisie in the Paris Commune and, of course, elsewhere in Europe. And Gramsci is saying a new order appeared, one in which the subordinate class, the working class, was subjugated to the dominant class through the creation of the organs of civil society. So what happens in 1871? You get the development of mass education, you get the development of political parties, you get the development, well, the spreading of church, but of course church had already been around for a long time, but it was more integrated in its relationship to the state. You get sort of the expansion also of telecommunications. You get a reconstruction of society that absorbs the working class into capitalist order and secures the domination of the bourgeoisie in a new way, namely through the organization of consent based on the rise of the civil society. Okay? Great. Now, let's turn to page, thank you very much, Aracelia. Now, I want you to read page 238. Somebody should read 238. No, I'm going to, I like this passage. I think it's great. I should underline all texts. I don't have to tell you what line to go for. So underline the top of the page. Kristen, why don't you read it?
In Russia, the state was everything.
Oh, no, you've got to do it with enthusiasm. You really look pissed off to be asked to do this. This is Gramsci. Antonio Gramsci.
In Russia, the state was everything.
The state was everything.
Civil society was primordial and gelatinous.
Civil society was primordial and gelatinous.
In the West, there was a proper relation between state and civil society.
In the West, there was a proper relationship between state and civil society.
And when the state trembled.
And when the state trembled, when it was attacked.
A sturdy structure of civil society.
A sturdy structure of civil society.
Was at once revealed.
Was at once revealed. Very good. That in there contains, in that sentence. Is it just one long sentence? Yep. No? Two. Two sentences contains the essence of Gramsci's ideas. What is Gramsci saying here? What is the difference between East and West, Russia and the West? Aman. Very good. Simple, but very good, very good, very good, very good. This is the, I'm going to draw you a picture of Russia and the West. Excuse me, Jason. Have I done something? Have I violated something? I will be punished soon. Yes. Gramsci will come down and punish me. Okay. There is Russia, the state. Remember, military and bureaucracy. That was whom? Who was this? Who wanted Lenin, right. Yes. Here is Russia. Now, Aman, how shall I draw the West?
West is
civil society between state and...
Yeah, well, we're going to drop the economy out. So there has to be a civil society.
Big triangle all the way
around. All the way around. Here. What we first of all have an expanded state, right?
Yeah.
Right, Conrad? And around it, we have... That's what it's... Yeah. But, Kristen, read the stuff about the last sentence of what you just read.
The state was only an outer ditch.
The state was only an outer ditch.
Behind which there stood a powerful system of fortresses and earthworks.
Now, man, what does that sentence say? Have I drawn the picture correctly? See, the picture they want me to draw. There's the outer ditch. The state. I don't know how to draw it. This is the state. And inside is what? Civil society. And what is Gramsci saying? Hands up. What is Gramsci saying? What is Gramsci saying? Jessica. Yeah, the state trembles when there is an attack upon the state. Then what happens? Then society is revealed. A sturdy society is revealed. Right? So, here, if you attack the state, what happens? Russia, you attack the state directly. What happens? The Tsar quits, the whole thing disintegrates, the Russian Revolution. So you can attack the state directly. A war, what Gramsci will call a war of movement. Direct assault on the state. Direct assault. Yes. Neil, you should understand all these military metaphors much better than me. War of movement. But here, if you attack the state... If you attack the White House, if you attack the State Department, or the World Trade Center, a society, a strong, powerful civil society is revealed. And there have been many instances, particularly in the 1920s, of attempts to attack the state, which were repelled immediately. The very famous 1923 putsch against, in Germany. Attempt to attack, say, Rosa Luxemburg, you know, in her imagination, in the end realized that was not the appropriate strategy, but the Spartacus League to which she belonged believed still, I think, in that assault on the state. And she had premonitions of the power of civil society, though she never theorized it as Gramsci did. So, and therefore, if you attack the state and society is revealed, therefore the strategy should be different. Revolutionary strategy should therefore be different, right? Revolutionary strategy should therefore be different. What is the logical consequence of this? This is the West. What's the logical consequence where civil society is out here, Zen's protecting the state? What is the logical consequence of this? What does revolutionary strategy now mean in the West where there is a strong civil society? Anders.
About infiltrating instead of
direct. Infiltrate the state. Infiltrate. What do you mean by infiltration? What do you mean by infiltration? Infiltration.
I guess it's like the Machiavellian idea.
Machiavellian idea.
At least what I've heard is a picture of the fox.
The fox.
The guy conceals that he's a fox.
Ah, like deceit. Deceit, cunning. Yes. Can you put some flesh on this idea of yours? This deceit, the cunning, work within the system.
You can also pretend to be someone supporting the state, and then
with your own.
Ah, you want to so infiltrate the state and then explode the state from within. Like a... That's almost like a terrorist, right?
Probably.
No, a terrorist is still a sort of movement, assault. You're still into assaults, aren't you? You're still into assaults. Yes, yes, yes. Mari.
Revolution would then have to work from civil society outwards to affect the state, change ideologies, religion, change.
How do you do that?
Through working with civil society.
Ah, and are you deceitful, like Anders is suggesting?
No, because that's too coercive.
Coercive, uh-huh,
uh-huh.
Uh-huh, very good. Yes, Neil.
The person in charge of state and nationalize civil society.
Oh, ho, 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 ho. Oh, that's an interesting idea. Take over the state and organize a revolution from above.
If you make everything the state, then it can go back to the war.
War of?
If you're in charge of the state and then everything that's, you know, civil society, church, school, you know, all that kind of stuff, if you nationalize all that stuff, then now everything is
so
no more society, so then you can go back to.
Oh, then you can go back to a war. Oh, you're that's a. Well, we're going to be around for centuries. Aha! You want to go. You want to turn. I take on the state, nationalize it, so we're back over here, and then we can have a war of movement. Ah, so there's only one. Yeah, you're an interesting chap because you're like Lenin. You're like Lenin because you then think there's only one way of having a revolution: war of movement, assault. And if we're not there, if we're here, then we have to go there so that we can have our war of movement.
You can kill an ideology.
Ah, yeah. Well, that's a sort of form of militarism, yeah. Yes, very interesting. Yes, 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 yes. Chelsea.
You might not be able to kill an ideology, but you can subsume it.
Ah.
And in that sense, I'd say subversive or circumversive. Is that a word even? Circumversive? Like, you need to go around and build a stronger, more expansive, inclusive hegemony that fits your, or an ideology that fits this new thing, so as to change both the consciousness of the masses and having them look at something differently, but to build a new strength, a new center, rather than civil society. I guess it would be similar, but different institutions, different ideas.
Interesting. Jason?
Well, I have two things. First is that when you're describing the strategy for the West, it kind of makes me think of, like, the caricature during the McCarthy period. Like, oh, communists are taking over the Boy Scouts, and they're taking over, like, every, you know. So it's everyone's kind of, like, yep, witch hunt, watching out for.
Ah.
But,
Oh, that's right. That's very interesting. So McCarthy had a vision of an alternative way in which United States society was being subverted because the communists were taking over every institution.
But I would disagree about the situation with Russia, because prior to the revolution, the working class built up their own institution, their own organization.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're going back to history and empirical examination, and we're in a theory course.
The Soviets were civil society.
Yeah. No, that's an interesting. That's a very, very interesting. Whether in fact, you know, whether there was or was not a civil society, whether it was primordial and gelatinous, and that's a fascinating question. Yeah, it's a fascinating question, and you can write your dissertation on it. Yeah, no, it is indeed. They were indeed building up during 1917, building up in the post immediate after the February Revolution. There was an opening up of spaces, so that indeed a sort of, I would say, a feeble, but nevertheless existent civil society was emerging between February 1917 and October 1917, which was essentially the Bolshevik and the Menshevik parties' movement. It was a working class movement. Yeah, but did not have decades of consolidation, as was the case in the West. Yes, 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 yes. All right. You're getting the idea. This was the McCarthy vision of the communists are taking over everything. Of course they weren't, but I mean, that vision is perhaps an indication of an alternative way of thinking of revolution, which was Chelsea was suggesting, which Mari was suggesting, that in fact the idea is to begin to conquer civil society before you conquer the state. to conquer civil society before you conquer the states. It's a very, very different form of revolution. This is the revolution Gramsci, Antonio Gramsci, brings to Marxism. He talks about a what? A war of position. So you begin to take over the institutions of civil society. And then finally, and only finally, do you have a war of movement, which is seizing control of the state. Whereas in Russia, what did you have to do? Here, according to Gramsci, you seize the state. Lenin and the Bolsheviks seize the state. But then what do you have to do?
Crazy.
Brilliant! Then you create, that's the war of position from above, you create a civil society, a socialist civil society, a war of position to create civil society, create civil society. Russia, the West. So, but this war of position is Gramsci's reformulation of what a revolution might mean in the context of the West. Seizing power and a direct assault on the state will not bring forth transformation, but only reaction. You have to, this is a long, slow process of conquest of civil society. Have you any idea of an example of this? We are, you know, if there were a really good example, we probably wouldn't be sitting here looking bored out of our minds. But there are examples. Yes.
I have a question.
You have a question, yeah.
I'm kind of lost. That map over there, is that the West as well?
Aha, we see. All right, very good, very good. Who are you?
Jonathan.
Angelica. Okay. Yes, that is the West too. You see? Bill Gramsci is drawing this picture saying, look, this is the wrong picture. It is the picture of the West, but it's a wrong picture. Gramsci is saying, look, if you draw this picture, you attack the state, and you think you're in Russia. But you forget that behind the state is all these civil society. So this is a wrong picture. I mean, it's a false strategy. What this picture implies is a false strategy. This is the right picture. You first of all, the state is at the final place of assault. But before then, you've got to conquer civil society. Okay? Yeah. 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 Hold on. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yes, Elizabeth. Yes, that's how it appears. If you attack the State Department or the White House, you will find that the whole of the U.S. civil society will be organized against you. Right. This is an indication of what would happen if you actually had a direct assault on the state. And this is the real picture in which you start out in the institutions of civil society. Yes, and then finally the state. So they're both pictures. They're basically, this is a wrong strategy and this is a picture of the right strategy. So this is the war of position becomes the war of movement. Here, the war of movement is really what's going on here. And in the West, you can't start with a war of movement. Right? Right? So what Gramsci is saying, we'll give an example in a minute. But what Gramsci is saying is that this is Lenin, right? Remember Lenin? Remember Lenin? That's Lenin. And Gramsci says, look, you're right. Well, actually, for Russia, there's hardly a moon. The moon is so thin, it's not true. You know, brightness and darkness don't even apply to this moon. It's a very, very thin moon. A legislative democracy is basically a repressive state held together by these thousand threads. Now what he says in the West is what? Well, basically, the story in the West is, and Gramsci doesn't, I mean, Lenin doesn't quite get this. Well, he does sometimes, but anyway, not in State and Revolution. He says, well, Gramsci says, in the West you've got all these apparatus of the state, but there's also something called civil society. And the thousand threads for Gramsci, the thousand threads, the important thousand threads are the thousand threads that connect the state to civil society. When I teach you here, in this university, I am subject to a whole set of regulations defined by the state. In schools, syllabi defined by the state, how to teach defined by the state, size of classrooms defined by the state. The state is actually directly and indirectly present in civil society. Though civil society appears to be autonomous, Gramsci's saying is actually connected by a thousand threads to the state. Those are the important threads. So that is the power of advanced or organized capitalism, the connections of this emergent civil society to the state. And therefore one has to engage in a war of position that slowly takes over civil society. All right, now you're asking me, what on earth is this war of position? What is it, right? That's what you're asking me, Karen. No, you're not asking me. Oh, that's a pity. Well, you should be asking me.
I'm kind of confused on that about the West, because I thought at the beginning you had said that a state would be the autocrat.
Yeah, there's two pictures of the West. There are people, there are revolutionaries in the world who think, there are still revolutionaries in the world, Jason, right? Who think you've got to seize state power. You go and seize the State House, White House, the State Department. And then you'll find there is a civil society. So that's this picture, and it's a false picture. This is the real, so you should forget about this because it's only going to lead to trouble. You're going to get killed for nothing. This is the right picture. This is the right picture. There's civil society around the state, so you have to creep in here. Creep in. Boop, 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 boop. But you've got to, there's no joke to, it's not easy to conquer. What do you mean to conquer civil society? Anybody got any notions, any ideas of what this war of position might be? Aaron?
Gramsci uses the example of boycotts or Gandhi's non-oppressive, non-violent.
Very, very good. BB, yes. Yes. Well, tell me more about... Well, what's how does he... boycotts are compared to what? That's a very good example.
Compared to direct assault.
Which is... specifically, who boycotts? Well, when you organize a boycott, who's organizing a boycott often? Usually.
The people who are marginalized or disempowered?
Yes, but who are they actually?
The working class,
right? You know? Obviously, you know, the great boycott in California was the boycott of?
Grapes,
right? The great boycott. The great grape boycott. The UFW, United Farm Workers, led by Cesar Chavez, right? But a boycott as opposed to what's the alternative strategy that workers can use? Strike, Lauren. Now, what is the difference now? This is it. This is not a fully fledged war of position, but this is the crucial question. What is the difference between a boycott and a strike?
Boycott, they actually march.
They actually march. Aha! Very hot. Ariana.
Boycott involve boycotting the product, but not buying the product,
whereas strike is the workers not producing the product. Aha! Very warm! Yes, Conrad!
I would say that usually boycotts are unified people who might not even be associated with with the product, whereas a strike are usually typically only workers.
Very good.
I was going to say, a boycott leads to the crisis of production. If you don't buy the product, the people are still working there, but nobody's buying it.
Mm.
If you have a strike, nobody's working. You don't let scabs.
Well, do you want to create a crisis of overproduction? Yeah, that may be the case. And a big scale. A big scale. All right, you really threw me for a loop then. Completely threw me for a loop. Because, I mean, it's interesting why you threw me for a loop. Because Gramsci is really talking about politics all the time. And you suddenly flung me back into economics. Very interesting. Very interesting. Yes, 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 yes. Yes, 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 yes. Yes, yes, yes. That's interesting. That's really interesting. But yeah, anyway, that's part of it. But there's the bigger issue that Conrad was suggesting, right? Is that boycotts, yes, Stacey, Tracy.
It involves different classes, not just one class.
Very good. So what you're all getting at is a boycott moves from the point of production where the strike takes place to the wider society. The great boycott involved a whole wide range of people, communities, organized together in support, indeed, of the farm workers. But it involved what? Civil society. Right, Carol? Yes. It involved organizing in civil society. And therefore, boycott is much more like a war of position than a war of movement. A war of movement, strike! And the capitalists are supposed to capitulate, and you're supposed to gain. Well, it doesn't always work that way. And if it doesn't work, it goes on and on, right, Felipe? The strike goes on and on. You've got to do what? You've got to gain the trust and support of the community again. But the boycott goes directly to the community. A great boycott is a way of appealing to all and presenting the interests of workers as the interests of all. So, yes, so that's a very good... Who was it who... Aaron, right. So that's very good. That's a very important distinction. Boycott and strike. Strike is like a war of movement, an assault on the capital, whereas a boycott is organizing in community and civil society. But can you give historically perhaps some example of a cumulative war of position, Tracy?
I was going to say Montgomery bus boycott.
The Montgomery bus boycott. Tracy, what was that about?
Rosa Parks
would not sit in the back of the bus where she was supposed to belong. Okay. Very good. And what happened as a result of that?
Well, she got kicked off the bus, and then there was a political movement.
There was a huge movement that followed.
They boycotted the bus system, so they didn't ride the buses. And for a while, it was okay, but then it started directly impacting higher class. It's not necessarily the high class, but it did, because they started losing their workers. So the women who were, man, this is a long story. So the women started giving rides to their babies and their... And so they kind of helped.
Right, so again, we see a mobilization of the community in Montgomery, Alabama. But what happened? That was 55. Before we get to 55, what really spurred... All right, Rosa Parks, an individual... No, individuals don't usually, when they make an individual protest, lead to a whole social movement. There was a context within which Rosa Parks did this. Brown versus Board of Education, which was about... 1954, which was... Go on, you're doing great. I mean, you must have written a paper on this. Go on.
That was about busing.
About segregation. Segregation. The elimination of segregation in education. And so this was a big... It was a move, in a sense, by the state, a legislative move by the state that... in a sense, inspired these social movements in civil society. So when Rosa Parks refuses to sit where she belongs, a bus boycott takes place, in Montgomery, Alabama. That's 1955. And then we get incredible organizing throughout the South in 1957, particularly under the Southern Leadership SCLC. Leadership conference. And who is associated with that?
Pastors.
Pastors, right. But isn't Martin Luther King already associated with that? And so what is involved? What is involved? What is this SCLC? What does SCLC lead? What is this social movement? What is this social movement in the South? It's about what? Hands up. Come on. Yes, Jenny.
War of position.
Yeah. We know it's a war of position. But what's it concretely about? Concretely.
Ideology.
No. Concretely, what are they organizing? Civil rights. Well, what are they actually doing on the ground? I want to be concrete about this. Yes, Juliana. Wait, it is, that's the intent. But what is actually happening on the ground? Yes. That there's a mass organization in the churches, but what is the object of this? It is to do what? What is the object of these struggles around the South? To do what?
To make public the injustice.
To make public the injustice, but what specific injustice? They have actual specific targets. Specific targets, this movement. Movements do not live on ideologies alone. They have specific practices and targets. What do they target? Oh, Matthew. Oh, state institutions. That's precisely what they were not targeting. Yes, Ian. What were they targeting?
Equal wages,
possibly. But where were they going? Yes.
They're targeting public areas.
Aha! What public areas?
Dining
areas. Restaurants. Go on. You're doing great.
Bathrooms.
I've not heard about bathrooms, but I'm sure bathrooms.
Schools.
What else?
Bus stations.
What else? Movie theaters. What else?
Water fountains.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Very good. What are these? These are all institutions in civil society. That was a war of position. That was an attempt to restructure, reorganize, a war of position, perhaps not with revolutionary intent, but an attempt to reorganize the institutions of civil society. But it didn't start with SCLC in 1957. It then moved on to sit-ins, as you may recall from your history books. Right, Stacey, 1960. What was the organization that gets involved in 1960? Yes, SNCC, which is... Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, against students from the South, mainly black students, who also begin to engage in desegregation protests around the institutions of civil society. And then we have the Freedom Rides associated with Core Congress on Racial Equality. Am I right? Congress on Racial Equality. Yeah. Yeah, and then that was 61 and 63, the march on D.C., Washington, D.C., famous march. And what happens in 64?
The Civil Rights Act.
What does the Civil Rights Act do? No, that was the Voting Act. That's the following year. Civil Rights Act basically outlawed racial segregation and racial discrimination in public places, followed by the... It's the following year, the Voting Act, Voting Rights Act. Yeah. And that was, of course, to outlaw so many of the practices that prevented African Americans from voting in elections. Okay, so you have a war of position that eventually had an impact on legislation. But then what happened? We're in 64, 65. What happens next? Right, we had a war of position. You have now, it's been in a sense absorbed by the state. New legislation outlaws discrimination. What happens next? 67, 68. The history books stop at 65? I bet they do. No, they don't. Jason, what happens next?
Urban
rebellions all over the country. Urban rebellions. What sort of urban rebellions?
I don't know, people are pissed off about a lot of stuff.
They're pissed off because, why are they pissed off? Because, of course, these are very, in a sense, in terms of their day-to-day life, this is still not enough. So what we get is an urban uprisings around the whole country, right? And they are really quite militant. You know, the Black Panthers down the road. We'll talk more about it when we get to Frantz Fanon, because Frantz Fanon inspired the Black Panthers. But the Black Panthers were not messing around. They carried rifles in the defense of the people. Right? There was Eldridge Cleaver and Bobby Seale and Huey Newton, the Black Panther. This was what? This was not a war of position. This was now a war of movement. And, of course, it was repressed as a war of movement, as Gramsci would say, as a war of movement would be in the context of an advanced capitalist society. Yeah. Yeah, so I think the civil rights movement gives us all sorts of Gramscian lessons, all sorts of Gramscian lessons and Gramscian illustrations of the war of position and, indeed, the war of movement. Yeah. 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 That's over here. Jessica?
I have a question, sorry to go back, it's just think about Barry Wright. Are you saying that the thousand threads are no longer with the capitalists, but
yeah, I think, well, who knows what's actually there? These are the threads that Gramsci's all... See, Gramsci's understanding why the revolution failed, right? And he's saying it's not because of these threads, but because, in fact, the civil society emerged connected to the state that absorbed any revolutionary tendency. So he's not denying these. He doesn't say anything about it. But he's focusing on the relationship between state and civil society. That's the focus, because he's concerned with a particular problem. Right? Very good. Yes, Juliana.
On the idea of the Black Panther, what happens when your war of position becomes detected by the state or the status of society, and then your war of position is directly assaulted, therefore you kind of take out a direct assault back?
Excellent. Absolutely. That is the dilemma. That is the dilemma. You develop an effective war of position, and yet you subject yourself, you make yourself necessarily visible, you subject yourself to assault from the state. What do you do then? You can only, in a sense, arm yourself. So a war of position, it might quickly move into a premature war of movement. Absolutely. But what will Gramsci say? We're going ahead, it doesn't matter. What will Gramsci say in response to that? Jason.
Right, I guess. That if you're really deeply rooted in the civil society, the people will back you up if something were to happen.
Right. So one thing is to be deeply rooted in civil society with great support from civil society, but to nurture that, you need a what? You need a what?
Support group.
Support group, but more than just a support group. You need something really very special, Aaron.
You need an open letter from James Baldwin.
An open letter from James Baldwin, that might help, it might help, it might not, it may just inflame the opposition, it might help, but there's more than movements, the war of position does not live on ideology alone, not by ideology alone. In fact, what is even more important than the ideology, what does the ideology actually make possible? There is something so crucial, what we've already mentioned today, that you've got to get this. And it's difficult for you to get this because of the society in which we live today. But there's a crucial element here for Gramsci, Jessica. Consent. Well, yes, you've got to consent. That's the idea that Jason's suggesting of it being deeply rooted, that the Black Panthers have to be deeply rooted in the community so that the people will support. But what are the conditions for that deep rootedness for Gramsci? Yes, but how are you going to share them? Who's going to share it? Who's going to do the sharing? Who's going to organize the sharing? No, not the state. The state is not going to do it, but the equivalent of the state. What is the equivalent of the state for the working class? Annie. Yes, but a particular type of intellectuals and a particular formation of the intellectuals, Chelsea? The political party, otherwise known as the
Modern prince.
You need a modern prince, a political party that will actually organize and orchestrate the conquest of civil society. But still, Juliana, your point is absolutely right. That this is an incredibly difficult project, this war of position. But without a party, Gramsci will say, you're not a chance. You're just not a chance. And of course, the Black Panthers were, in a sense, a party. And you might say, and it'd be a good dissertation, to study whether and to what extent it was a Gramscian modern prince party that was organizing the consent of the people. But that idea is very important. Yes, this is tricky stuff. This is very tricky stuff. We will continue to talk about it. Yes, Ian. Why? He doesn't say that the Russian Revolution failed. Well, not explicitly, and we're not saying that here. He says that the Russian Revolution, in fact, was a great success. The Bolsheviks seized power. But they, therefore, and they seized power directly, correctly, because there was no civil society, you could seize power directly, but then the task was what? To create a whole new civil society from the top down. So you start with a war of movement, and then you have a war of position from the top to build a whole new socialist world, which they tried to do in the 1920s, I might say. Yes. Okay? So it wasn't a failure. The failure was the revolution in the West. There was no revolution, quote, in the West. That's what failed, not the one in Russia.
Because they applied the same Russian model.
Yes, in part because they couldn't think of a model of revolution other than the Russian one. After all previous revolutions had been on the sort of Russian one. The French Revolution, even the Chinese Revolution had been... Well, of course, that was much later. Let's stick with the French one. The idea was, of course, that you are able to seize state power. But now we're in completely different configuration of society. And a developed civil society. You cannot apply the same model. You have to have a completely different model. That's his critique of Lenin. Lenin, you were right for Russia, but don't make a virtue out of a necessity. Don't universalize your model. We need a different model. Huh? Right. Now, perhaps we should just go back over here to Russia. Are there any other examples of such revolutions today in the world? That's an interesting question. When you read the text, you'll have to decide. That obviously be one of the questions. Was the Cuban Revolution a war of movement or a war of position? And what is the relationship between the two of them? Juliana's story about the dilemmas of the Black Panthers underlines something that Gramsci does not underline sufficiently, namely that you have to think of the relationship between war of position and war of movement, that they don't exist one, then the other. They actually, and we'll see that in the Cuban Revolution, I think. But yes, so Cuban, so basically Third World Revolutions are often parallel to the Russian Revolution because civil society is relatively undeveloped, yes. Yes, indeed, 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 indeed. Yeah, yeah, very good, very good, very good. Very good, very good. Yes. Well, we'll see when we get to Fanon before we get to the Cuban Revolution. You know, how he understands war of position and war of movement in a colonial and post-colonial context. Yes, 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 very good. All right. Now we're on to socialism. You've been waiting for this, I know. yes, so well, you've already begun. We've already begun. Your questions have been great. You've already begun to ask the big question. So how can this war of position, how can this war of position develop? Very tricky. Well, what Gramsci says is basically a war of position has to, just as the cap, when the Bolsheviks take power, But in this model, what do you have to do? You have to cut the thousand threads. And here you sense, Gramsci says the same, you have to cut the thousand threads and reorganize civil society. Reorganize civil society. Yeah. 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 Right. Page 265. 265. Whew. Neil, it's just getting exciting. Oh, I know. Army calls. All right, 65. Right. Here we go, 265. I'm going to read. 265, the top of the page where it's underlined. Are you there, Sonny?
Yes.
Very good. All right. It always happens. Are we there, Hian? It always happens that individuals belong to more than one private association, and often associations which are objectively in contradiction to one another. A total, we can call them total policy, a totalistic policy, a totalizing policy, is aimed precisely, this is the policy of the modern prince, the party, right? The war of position, aimed one at ensuring that the members of a particular party, the modern prince, find in that party all the satisfactions that they formerly found in a multiplicity of organizations, i.e. it's breaking all the threads. You thought I was inventing those threads. i.e. breaking all the threads that bind these members to extraneous cultural organisms. So the idea is that you sort of have to sort of, in a sense, seal off civil society in this war of position. Yes. And then second, at destroying all other organizations or incorporating them into a system of which the party is the sole regulator. So essentially the party has to reorganize civil society under its direction, under its hegemony, if you will. This occurs, one, when the given party is the bearer of a new culture. Then one has a progressive faith. So you're right about this ideology, I think it was Aaron. Yes, you know, a new culture that sort of... that also galvanizes the people, that sort of acts on their imagination, gives a whole new idea of what could possibly be possible. Yes. Then one, when the given party is the bearer of a new culture, then one has a progressive phase. But two, when the given party wishes to prevent another force, bearer of a new culture, from becoming itself total, then one has an objectively regressive and reactionary phase, even if that reaction does not avow itself and seeks itself to appear as the bearer of a new culture. What is he talking about there? The reactionary phase, all right? The progressive phase, there is emerging a new civil society organized by the party with a new vision of the future. We might call it a prefigurative politics. But there's also a reactionary phase, a reactionary moment, in which civil society is also organized, but now in opposition to the new emergent civil society. What is he talking about, do you think? It's hard. It's hard. You don't know. It's difficult to give examples. I mean, actually, Juliana had an example, all right? The Black Panthers organized, but then there's an organization against the Black Panthers. From trying to, not just the state, but within civil society, there's organizing against Black Panthers. A beautiful example that I happened to come across yesterday, thanks to Gabe Hetland, who is studying Bolivia, amongst other things. In Bolivia, you correct me if I am wrong, in Bolivia we have actually an emergent war of position, organized social movements under the Socialist Party, MAS. But then there is also what? A reaction from the right, the right wing that is also organizing in civil society. There's almost a civil war. And the right wing organizes these, what they call these, civic committees, and also presents its interests as the interests of all, and demonizes the socialists. There is, that's what Gramsci's talking about. If you start organizing a war of position, a progressive one with socialist imaginations, you are likely to generate a reaction from within civil society against the progressive movement, presenting itself as the interests of all, but in fact often very closely related to the dominant class. So Bolivia will be an interesting place today of this clash within civil society of a left socialist war of position facing opposition from the right. And I think if one looked at the Black Panthers, one might find something similar happened there, though not quite as self-consciously organized. I mean, it's like a violent civil war at points in Bolivia, as I understand
it.
Yeah,
it's a war of movement as well.
Yeah, it's a war of movements. I mean, the war of position and the war of movement are really bound up to with one another. Yeah, very good. Okay, so anyway, the point is that you've got to cut the thousand threads, you've got to change the existing institutions and create alternative ones. It happened on this campus! 1964? 65? Yes, it happened on this campus. This campus, this university was reorganized under the control of the Democratic People's Republic of Students, Berkeley students. You know, you just go to, you must go all the time to the Free Speech Cafe and all those pictures up there. And yeah, I mean, you know, it was just, it's like socialism in one campus. Well, it wasn't really socialism, but it was confined. It was confined, like, of course, the tragedy of the workers' occupations in Turin in 1919 and 1920. But anyway, there's inklings of that around the world, inklings of what a war of position might mean. Okay, very good. All right, that's one thing. Cutting those thousand threads and changing institutions. How will this happen? Well, the point is, you're working class, and this is the real problem. The working class, and this is, of course, the dilemma that the Black Panthers have, as Juliana says. The working class doesn't have what? It doesn't have at its disposal what institution? It doesn't have at its disposal which institution? Hands up, yes?
The military.
The military. Very good, Vijayita. Yes. Very good. Yes. The military, the state. The state ultimately reproduces a domination of what class? The dominant class, the ruling class. So the working class hasn't got access to force. So it has access, it has to organize consent. But what else doesn't it have access to? It doesn't have material resources to make concessions. But it does have one thing, doesn't it, Aaron? Ideology. So that's one thing that is very important, is that for this war of position to be cemented, to be developed, for Gramsci says, it has to have ideology. And ideology, you can read the definition, a beautiful definition of ideology on page 126, all underlined for you. It's just one sentence. But it is the idea of ideas galvanizing atomized people into collective action. Yes! But also what is important is, of course, the party, the modern prince. And we should look on page 133 to say what he says about our modern prince. 133. Where are we? Ah, yeah. Whoa, that's a long passage. All right, I'll just read the first paragraph. These two basic points, the formation of a national popular collective will, national popular collective will, that is, popular collective will from below, the working class and its allies, of which the modern prince is at one and the same time the organizer and the active operative expression, the organizer and the expression of this national popular will from below, and the intellectual and moral reform should structure the entire work. So the two basic points, the formation of a national popular collective will and the importance of an intellectual moral reform, that is a project, a vision of an alternative future. Yep. Those are the two crucial ingredients that the party has got to put forward. The concrete programmatic points must be incorporated in the first part. That is, they should result from the line of discussion dramatically and not be a cold and pedantic exposition of arguments. The ideas expressed in this intellectual and moral form have got to be living ideas. They have got to speak to the lived experience of the people they're supposed to mobilize. Of course, what happened to Marxism? So for Gramsci, Marxism did perform that ideological role, particularly in Russia, so he said. But what happened to Marxism over the years is that it became encrusted, it became dogmatic, it became cold and utopian and distant and ritualistic, and it became, above all else, academic. So it lost its power as an ideology, as a power to motivate and propel people. What ideologies are there in the world, you think, or have there been in the world, that have propelled people into action? Why do I always mix you people up last? This is last, right?
Yeah.
Nationalism, very good, very good. Nationalism, that's very good. Of course, in a sense, nationalism is transplants. It's a dominant ideology, but nationalism, indeed. Yeah, through wars, people. I mean, you know, I mean, Neil is gone, but he could have talked about that. And he will, he said he would. We're going to have a nice discussion with Neil about all these sorts of things. Yes, Lauren.
What about religious ideas?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like, such as?
What's up?
Such as?
Like, in the Middle East, like, Muslim.
Right, Islamic religions. We think, you know, we need more sociology of this, but we think that they are very powerful in their capacity to mobilize people, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, we need to know more about that. It may or may not be true, but that's how we think. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Jane?
Nazism.
Uh-huh. So it's a form of nationalism. Yeah. It's interesting what we're talking about. I mean, yes, I mean, there's a, yeah. Religion, nationalism, yeah. What else? Anything 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 else? Tian? Tian? Hmm? Capitalism. Aha! What would be the variety of capitalism? Very good. Capitalist ideology. What sort?
Well, I keep thinking of Adam Smith talking about, like, the nations pirating, colonizing, like, for riches.
But is that an ideology that mobilizes people collectively, Isaac?
Neoliberalism.
Well, that's an interesting question. Does neoliberalism mobilize people? Huh? Does it? Who does it mobilize, Isaac?
Mobilizes
first world nations. Does it mobilize people into collective action, or does it mobilize states? An interesting question. An interesting question. And of course, none of you said socialism. None of you. Well, isn't that interesting? Well, yes. Well, that's probably a sign of the times. Okay, oh, I've got a minute and a half. Relax. Hey, Claudette. Is it Claudette? I have a mobilizing eye. Hey, look at the ladies at the back there. Creeping out. That subversive war of position. Yes. Okay, so final question before you go. What is socialism? What is socialism for Gramsci? What is socialism for Gramsci? Ha! What is socialism for Gramsci? What is socialism for Gramsci? I'm going to say it once more. What is socialism for Gramsci? You don't know? Find out. We'll talk about it on Thursday. And we'll talk about pages 180 to 181. Very good. And all those stuff about intellectuals.